I was at this RAF tactical station a few hours ago. These pilots covered not only the actual invasion coast, but roads and railroads far behind what may be termed the front line. Except for one railroad train and scattered motor cars and trucks, there was no road transport to be seen in this entire region. I'm not basing my opinion merely on the strength of what a second party said. I actually talked to and sat in on the interrogations of each and every light bomber crew that returned. There's also a sneaking suspicion in my mind that the Germans were prepared for something entirely different. One, they may have expected the invasion in the Pas-de-Calais area. After all, that is the closest to the British Channel coast, and we've repeatedly bombed this area in recent weeks. I had an interesting talk with the group captain of this RAF tactical air base. He said that, costly though these diversionary raids may have been, they served their purpose in steering the Germans far wide of the true objective to be hit. In all this diversionary tactic, don't forget the complete disruption of bridge communications across the River Seine. Secondly, there is also a certain amount of substantiation for the belief that the Germans felt we were not quite prepared to attack at the present time. There is incontrovertible proof that the Germans have moved 600,000 motor vehicles to the Russian front in recent weeks. That doesn't sound much like they were contemplating an invasion in the strength of the present one. Figures may be misleading in an operation of this dimension, but let me give you a few which are reliable. We used between 3,000 to 5,000 landing craft and ships in this operation. The figure closer to 5,000 may be the more accurate. In the hours before H hour, the British, using an estimated 1,200 aircraft, dropped between 6,000 to 8,000 tons of bombs on the invasion coast. This means that each and every aircraft carried a maximum load. If I can judge by the bombing briefing which I attended in the hours just prior to H hour, I would hazard the guess that not one of these bombs was wasted. Not only was our offensive weapon keyed to its highest pitch, but similarly, our defensive weapons were no less formidable. For instance, you have undoubtedly heard of the Allied planes shot down by Allied ships and anti-aircraft in the invasion of Italy. General Eisenhower was quick to realize this potential danger. So, in the hours just before takeoff time, the wings and the bellies of all Allied craft, British as well as American, were painted with alternative black and white stripes. They were so visible even in darkness that many pilots from the RAF wing which I visited gave a start every time they turned their head sufficiently to see this new type of identification mark. But the heroes in this invasion are not only numbered among the airmen, nor are they solely the G.I. boys who had to go in and face everything which the Jerry had. G.I. Joe and all his buddies had to be landed at an exact spot on the Cherbourg coast in order to make the initial opening a successful one. So midget submarines, the type that went into the coast of Norway to plaster the German battleship Tirpitz, were called on to supply markers for the invasion barges. They left these friendly shores 3 days ago, creeping in by inches at times to gain admittance to what the Germans preferred to hold as forbidden territory. But the submarines got through. Their markers were up, and the landing craft went in. One only needs talk with an initiated person to gain complete confidence in the operations just begun. I've done so. I know of the tremendous strength involved. I also know something of the potential strength of the Germans in the invasion territory. Since I have complete confidence in the authenticity of the picture painted for me, I also have complete confidence in the success of these operations. A glance into the London sky early this morning would have given each and every one of you that same confidence. We're on the march. We can only hope that the Germans are on the march backward.
You've just heard David Anderson. And now?
This is Ed Hawker, just back from a flight over part of the battle area with the 9th Air Force. The invasion of continental Europe from the west, and we now know it's in full swing this morning, was undoubtedly the most closely guarded secret of this war.
part of the story can now be told from the correspondent's point of view. We all know how General Eisenhower, before the invasion of Sicily, took the war correspondents into his confidence, told them of his plans, even went so far as to give them a pretty good idea of when it would take place. Not so this time. If any correspondent was taken into the general's confidence, it would be a surprise indeed to some who have enjoyed this privilege in the past. During the last few weeks, as the world was forewarned, there have been feints. Correspondents, some of the best, were called by phone, told to report at a certain place, were then escorted to points far removed from London, were wined and dined, in a manner of speaking, and then just as abruptly sent back to London. One group was kept out of circulation for 10 days. My own call came on Friday. It so happened I'd gone to the 9th Bomber Command to interview General Sam Anderson and one of his colonels. I'd had it, as the RAF flyers express it. A call from London instructed the 9th Bomber Command to keep me. On Saturday, to transfer me to a 9th Bomber Command station. But even then, I thought it was part of another feint. Well, I should say I didn't till yesterday. Beginning in the early morning, command cars started to appear at the station, more than usual. The MPs, who usually ride around the station in a jeep, suddenly took to walking, and they were curious as to where I was going. In addition, the personnel, even including the correspondents, were told to remain. No moving off base at night for a few quick mild and bitters in the nearby pub. We were under lock and key, and it suddenly began to dawn on us that great events were in the offing. Our first official word that D-Day finally had arrived was given us at about 10 o'clock last night, British time. I sat in a small Nissen hut at the bomber station, just talking about friends back home, our families and children. The door opened and the base commander, Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Seymour, came in. "Be ready to fly in the morning," he said. "Be ready to be briefed at such and such a time." That meant D-Day, of course. We had planned no operational flight other than the one for D-Day. Within a few hours, we'd washed and shaved, for what reason I don't know. We had had our snack at the officer's mess. Then to the briefing room, where Colonel Seymour stood waiting for his flyers to seat themselves. A large, brightly lighted Nissen hut covered with maps and charts of Hitler's Europe. Like the men who bomb and have been bombing Europe day after day, Seymour rarely puts on any display of dramatics. He said, "Now, fellows, this is what you've been waiting for." And his voice was no more dramatic than that. "This," he said, "is Invasion Day." And then he and his intelligence officers gave us the information we had been waiting to hear, where it was going to take place. For an hour and a half, he briefed us, repeated time and time again the words that today's bombing had to be good, that men crossing the channel at that very moment were depending on it. He closed the briefing with three messages, one from General Anderson, one from Air Marshal Sir Trafford Lee Mallory, one, finally, from General Eisenhower. So it was at all the stations of the 9th Bomber Command early this morning, and in each case, it was followed by crews of men filing out into the moonlit night, each crew to its own marauder, parked in the diversion area. The name of the plane that took me to see the opening of this great invasion is Hoots Zooch Shooter. We took off before dawn. The rendezvous was about an hour off, someplace along the channel, possibly out in the channel, it doesn't matter. As we approached, so did many other planes, their silhouettes outlined by the full moon. And then as the dawn of a new day spread out over occupied Europe, the marauders pointed their noses toward the east, headed for their target on the French coast. Below, as my eyes got used to the light, I counted upwards of 60 invasion boats. There were more later, hundreds. Above, the skies were filled with an infinity of planes of all descriptions. Beyond, closer to the French coast, Allied ships of war were blasting the targets along the invasion beaches. That was the picture as France loomed through the sun-beamed haze and clouds. And then shortly, too shortly, in fact, we were over the coast, heading toward our target, only 3 minutes away.
It was an effective bombing. I saw it. The smoke, flame, and dust testified to that. And then, sitting in the waist of that B-26, I saw the flag, light but strong, rise out around our formation. I had a sudden sensation of fear, and only after crossing the coast, headed back toward England, did I again regain my composure. Off to my left, a young bombardier sitting in the plexiglass office sat reading a newspaper. That helps, too. As for the battle itself, I certainly can't picture the turn of events from an eyewitness story from the waist of a B-26. But one thing for sure, while I saw some German planes go over Europe today, the mastery of the skies is ours. Your guess is as good as mine as to where the Luftwaffe is. But Prime Minister Churchill today, as it's already been pointed out, said 11,000 Allied planes are available. It's estimated 7,000 of these were used this morning. 5,000 bombers of all types and 2,000 fighters, or in fighter strength alone, equal to all those available to Germany.
You just heard the eyewitness reports of NBC's own staff correspondents, Wright Bryan, David Anderson, and Ed Hawker, all of whom have just returned from the frontline invasion area. This is John W. Vanderkirk returning you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
Thank you, Stanley Richardson, Merrill Muller, John Vanderkirk, David Anderson, Wright Bryan, and Ed Hawker, for your on-the-spot reports of this great day. You have given us a well-rounded picture in these last 40 minutes of the diverse operations that we call invasion. And while you have been speaking, we have received a recording from Ralph Howard in Rome, the captured Italian capital. And we now bring you that recording.
This is Ralph Howard speaking from Rome. The opening of the second front on the northern coast of France is being announced to the people of Rome. And for the second day, the town is cheering and shouting in wild ecstasy. The first official announcement here in Rome was made over army loudspeakers in the Piazza Venezia, where thousands of persons were gathered. A tremendous cheer went up when the announcement was made in Italian, and American, British, and French soldiers in the vicinity were grabbed around the neck and kissed and hugged. Everyone wants to shake your hand, and it took me 10 minutes this morning to walk 4 blocks because of the many interruptions. Like yesterday, the main streets of Rome are packed with people. They don't seem to be going in any particular direction. They just want to be out and watch the long lines of jeeps and military vehicles move slowly through the streets. The feeling is electric, and the word of the Western invasion is spreading like wildfire. Small groups of people call to one another, spreading the news, and those first hearing of it immediately break into smiles and want to shake the hand of the nearest person. I've been able to talk with only a few American boys this morning about the Western invasion, but I believe their reaction is typical. Private Lionel Lear of Manchester, New Hampshire, said, "When our boys know that someone is pushing from the other side, it will help their morale 100%. There won't be any lag in the attending campaign, or as far as the boys are concerned, if they know that we really have the Jerrys on the run." Sergeant Belmont Fisher of New York City told me, "We've been talking about the second front now for months. Everybody had bets down on when it would come, but even now it's a surprise, but a swell one. Now the boys will start betting on when the war will be over." One captain said that when his men heard the news this morning, a lot of them wanted to start an invasion of their own from the Rome area to the southern flank. With all our forces starting to bet on the date of the final victory, German troops are being pushed over to the Tiber River, and military commanders say that in many places the enemy is in general state of confusion. Official Nazi papers have been found recording the fact that desertions and self-inflicted wounds are increasing tremendously among the German troops. Excessive drinking has also increased. Complaints and disputed statements will be punished to prevent the degeneration of our forces and not the orders reached. It will be very interesting to watch the reaction of German forces here in Italy when they hear news of the Western invasion. From Rome, I return you now to the NBC newsroom in New York.
That was a recording by Ralph Howard from the newly captured city of Rome. Let me now summarize the invasion situation as it stands at this time some 6 hours after we had the first news that it was underway. We have landed on 2 points of the Normandy coast between Cherbourg and Le Havre, and we have established ourselves on those beachheads successfully. From those 2 points, our troops have succeeded in marching inland. That is the test of a successful beachhead. The fact that the troops that have landed there can proceed from their original landing point and make their way inland. You will remember at Dieppe, we never succeeded in getting inland at all. We landed, but were forced to go back. Here, we have landed successfully. We have made landings at other points also, but so far as we know, we are marching inland from 2 points only. We have word that we have taken 2 Channel Islands, Guernsey and Jersey. They are important for later operations. The chances are that we will establish airfields there for further development of the operation. Marshal Pétain has just broadcast over the Nazi-controlled Paris radio, appealing to the French people not to aggravate our misfortunes by acts which would bring upon you tragic reprisals. The Marshal's voice has long ceased to have any power with the French people. The voice to which they listened today was that of General Eisenhower, telling them what lay ahead. We know that there has been a naval battle in the estuary of the Seine River. That naval battle, according to German reports, we have won. The Germans also tell us that there is heavy fighting at Caen. That is a matter of 20-odd miles inland in Normandy. It is an important railroad center where our paratroops landed and where they are now defending the points which they seized. London tells us that German destroyers and E-boats, that's motor torpedo boats, were reported to be entering the Allied operational area off the coast of France. That means that we are following up this initial success in the Seine estuary. There was a heavy bombardment of the British Channel coast across the Straits of Dover. That bombardment lasted for 45 minutes. Immediately after it began, Allied bombers escorted by fighters took off from British bases and winged their way across. And within a few minutes after their arrival over French soil, the bombardment ceased. There is every indication that everywhere along the French coast we met less opposition than we had expected. The obstacles encountered were less severe than we had supposed. The initial landings have been successfully completed. We have landed at least 60,000 paratroopers, British and American, at various points in Normandy. Undoubtedly, according to what we have heard so far, they are holding their positions. The initial phase of the invasion has been successful. That, of course, is the initial stage. The Germans will now bring up reinforcements, and the real struggle will begin. But every Allied leader is satisfied with the progress made so far.
The National Broadcasting Company, continuing our complete coverage of the invasion news, takes you now to the NBC newsroom in Washington.
And this is Richard Harkness in our nation's capital. If I had only one word to describe Washington this historic D-Day morning, that word would be that our nation's capital is confident. There is a feeling here that now the invasion is underway, it will succeed. But before the day is out, we undoubtedly will have some word direct from President Roosevelt. The President is scheduled to hold his regular press and radio conference this afternoon at 4 o'clock, and, of course, Mr. Roosevelt will undoubtedly comment on the progress of the invasion. Well, certainly, that word, confident, describes the mood of President Roosevelt last night, only a few hours before our invasion of Hitler's Fortress Europe was formally announced. As you know, Mr. Roosevelt broadcast last night on the liberation of Rome. Well, as commander-in-chief, the president certainly knew what was coming in Europe before the night was over. But as he sat in the White House waiting to broadcast, He gave no hint to the little personal crowd which jammed into his broadcasting room. Mr. Roosevelt was surrounded by his family. Mrs. Roosevelt is in Washington, and so are the president's two grandchildren, Sissy and Buzzy, his daughter, Mrs. Anna Bodiger, and his son-in-law, Major John Bodiger. Well, the president was in an unusually good humor. He joked with the network announcers and engineers. The president drew a big laugh when he threatened to mention Anthony Muto, Tony Muto, a newsreel man of Italian descent, along with Christopher Columbus, Marconi, and other prominent Italians who have contributed to world progress. So the president, obviously, was confident of the outcome of this mighty Allied invasion. He even slept through the early hours of the attack. Well, another person who knew what was coming was General George C. Marshall, the chief of staff. Well, General Marshall was the honored guest last evening at the Russian embassy, where he received one of the highest military decorations the Soviet can give. Well, it can be told now that the general puzzled an imposing list of dignitaries when he declined to wait for the customary buffet supper, which, incidentally, is very good at the Russian embassy. But the answer came within a few hours when General Eisenhower's headquarters announced the invasion, and now everyone knows why General Marshall went home early last night. Then Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson set an example of confidence. He stayed at home during the small hours of the morning when the news was being flashed all over the world. As you recall, Mr. Stimson had told a news conference days ago that we won't start the invasion until we are sure of its success. Well, meanwhile, the House will meet at 11 o'clock Eastern Wartime this morning to consider the price control extension bill, and the Senate will meet at noon to work on the same subject. But it is quite likely that most of our representatives, and our senators too, will spend their time in the cloakrooms with their ears glued to the radio for the latest invasion bulletins. Well, Washington, of course, is an international city. There is a little bit of England here at the British Embassy. There's a little bit of France, for instance, at the French legation. The British ambassador, the tall, gaunt Lord Halifax, is the first diplomat to make a direct statement on the invasion. Lord Halifax says that he has no doubt that we will have very tough fighting on the continent of Europe. But Lord Halifax goes on to say that we all have complete confidence in General Eisenhower, complete confidence in his deputy commanders, and complete confidence in all our Allied troops. Well, that statement of Lord Halifax seems to summarize, perhaps better than any other statement, the way Washington feels about this invasion. Complete confidence in the men who are doing the fighting, and complete confidence in the men who are in our high command. Well, as a city, Washington is taking the invasion calmly. The nightclubs and cocktail lounges still were packed when the German radio proclaimed the invasion at 12:37 Eastern Wartime this morning. But the city had been fooled by that Associated Press flash for two brief minutes last Saturday, so this time Washington was a little blasé about it. Then, of course, when Allied confirmation came at 3:32 a.m., most of the people were in bed. However, a list of Washington dignitaries had asked the NBC newsroom some weeks ago to call them at any hour when the invasion comes. So about 4 o'clock this morning, we of NBC here routed out, Dr. Alexander Loudon, the ambassador from the Netherlands, and we awakened Senator Barkley, the majority leader of the Senate from Kentucky. We routed out Speaker Sam Rayburn of Texas, and then Representative Joe Martin, who is the minority leader. And then when the Capitol awakened this morning, there was little evidence of real excitement. People jammed their way onto Washington's overcrowded streetcars and buses and went to work as usual. So far here in Washington, there have been no whistles or no ringing of bells. It's just another workaday Tuesday in this world's biggest business, which is the United States government. However, news dealers on the downtown corners report that their sale of newspapers has been fairly brisk so far. And I noticed that people having their orange juice, toast, and coffee in downtown restaurants this morning all had their noses buried in the newspapers or were cocking an ear for radios, which do seem to be going full blast all over town. Well, among the street crowds here in Washington, reaction is slow. A streetcar motorman, alluding to the Associated Press's false invasion announcement Saturday, said, "I heard another announcement a couple of days ago, and I want to wait and see on this one." However, there is an air of grimness here. A large group gathered at St. John's, the Church of the Presidents, and special D-Day prayers were read this morning. Well, as this business goes on as usual here in Washington, it is all connected, of course, with the war. For instance, Leo T. Crowley, our foreign economic administrator, says that he is leaving soon for Italy to make a personal inspection of the relief problems brought up by our liberation of Rome. Then on Capitol Hill, reaction to the invasion is one of prayer for the success of our American and our British soldiers. Meanwhile, referring to another phase of the war, Senator Homer Ferguson, a Republican from Michigan, announces that he will demand a congressional investigation into the Pearl Harbor tragedy. The House is scheduled to vote on a resolution extending the time for trial of the Pearl Harbor commander. And then another story here, which on a normal day would be a front page, top headline story. A special House committee is planning to hear this morning Montgomery Ward Chairman Sewell Avery testify in its probe of seizure of the mail order firm by the United States Army. Well, one of the civilians largely responsible for the success of this invasion mounted today is Mr. Donald M. Nelson, the chairman of the War Production Board. Well, the invasion itself found Nelson outside of Washington and typically found him at work spurring the country to new production records. Nelson is in Detroit, and in this big war center, his schedule today calls for conferences to try to iron out some of Detroit's strike troubles. Nelson was informed of the invasion during the early morning hours, but he had no comment to offer. Yesterday, you'll remember, the War Production Board chairman delivered a rather scathing rebuke to both management and labor for industrial unrest as the invasion hour approached. And today, it's expected that Mr. Nelson will undoubtedly elaborate on his statement. So, if I may summarize, Washington is taking the invasion in its stride with an air of calm confidence.
You have just heard Richard Harkness speaking from Washington. Now NBC continues its coverage of the invasion as we return you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
Here we are back in the NBC newsroom in New York, and coming toward the microphone at this time to give you more of the last-minute flashes as they're coming over the wire is Robert St. John.
Here's one from London, which quotes the German DNB agency as broadcasting a report that Allied tanks have penetrated several kilometers into France. That looks as if we are deepening our bridgehead, as if we have begun to go places in France. And here's one that quotes the German Transocean agency as broadcasting the claim that almost 80 medium-sized warships are approaching our beachhead in France. Now, that bulletin doesn't say what kind of warships they are. I assume they are Allied warships. And here's another bulletin from a U.S. fighter base in England, which says that Thunderbolt pilots returning from the invasion area today reported that Allied troops are piling onto the shore of France virtually with no opposition, and that the skies are practically clear of German planes. And here's another bulletin. Just a second. Here's one more bulletin. Here we are. Another bulletin that says big guns on the French coast opened fire across the Strait of Dover shortly after midday today. A salvo of four shells was seen to explode. And here's another one. The German Transocean News Agency says that Allied paratroopers have landed on the islands of Jersey and Guernsey west of the Norman Peninsula. And here's another one. The German High Command, in its first invasion communique today, said Allied forces suffered very heavy reverses in the Cannes area of northern France, and it claimed that an entire regiment of paratroopers was destroyed in that sector.